Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 5th. Excited to have with us this week David Gibson, the author of The Rule of Benedict and also the blogger at Benedictions at beliefnet.com, has been very busy this week with the Pope's visit. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be here.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for coming. I know it's been a busy week, but we're here to do sort of a post-mortem on the Pope's visit. So why don't we start by just getting a sense, Dave, where did you think, what were your expectations for the trip when it first started?
I think my expectations were that, you know, he would try to reintroduce himself, in a sense, to the Catholic Church in the United States, to all of the United States, basically, and in the sense of, you know, reintroducing Joseph Ratzinger as Pope Benedict XVI, because he'd had this long-standing reputation, which, you know, we all know about, and he wanted to show himself as the pastor, the shepherd, you know, the German shepherd, as people have taken to calling him, instead of God's Rottweiler. And I think, you know, we expected him to do that, and I think he was extremely successful in doing that. But, you know, I think the irony is he was successful in doing that not in the way I think the Vatican or the people around him expected or wanted him to do. They were very concerned, I think, that the sexual abuse crisis storyline not dominate the visit. And yet, from the very first comments on the papal plane coming over about his deep shame over the scandal, that storyline did dominate the headlines. He mentioned it for the first 3 or 4 days running. Again, the paradox is that his direct approach to the scandal and his very forthright comments about it showed him to be the pastoral type of person and pope that the Vatican had hoped people would see. So I think if he had tried to soft pedal it in any way, which I don't think he would do, he would not have come off as well. So it's a good thing, I think, he listened to his own counsel and the counsel of the American bishops.
So you have any sense of exactly how this played out in terms of the sexual abuse comment? There were some advising him perhaps to be a little more cautious and not to address this, but it was the American bishops, in particular Cardinal O'Malley, who pushed for him to meet with the victims?
Yeah, I think a lot of credit has to go to the American leadership here for pushing him to do this, but especially to Cardinal O'Malley. You know, he had pushed very strongly behind the scenes for the Pope to come to Boston, the ground zero, as it were, of the Catholic Church in this crisis. And the Pope decided not to do that. I mean, he's 81. I'm exhausted. I don't know. You know, I hope he's got a few days at Castel Gandolfo to take some rest. But, you know, he knew, I think, that would have been a city too far for him. But O'Malley, you know, insisted that something had to be done, something even more than just words. So he continued to try and find avenues to get the Pope to address this in pastoral action as well as prophetic words. And so he wound up bringing that group of five sexual abuse victims down to meet the Pope in Washington. If the Pope wasn't going to go to Boston, then Boston was going to go to the Pope. So I think I think that's something that the Pope deserves praise for doing. But we also have to realize that, you know, I think Cardinal O'Malley in particular was instrumental in this. And also you have to go back and look at the people, the victims' rights groups, the media, lay groups from the National Review Board, Anne Burke, to Voice of the Faithful, all of these groups that had continued to put so much pressure to open this scandal up. Without their advocacy for years, often in the wilderness, we would not have reached this point of true catharsis, which I think happened in these past days.
So there's been much speculation about what the next step is, whether there will be any further action on the sexual abuse front, whether from a canon law perspective, or whether perhaps any bishops might be disciplined, as some victims' advocates are calling for. Do you think there's going to be anything more, or is this sort of, this is what the Vatican was going to do?
I think this is what the Vatican was going to do. We talked to Cardinal Levada Cardinal William Levada, former San Francisco Archbishop, who's now, who Benedict himself called over to the Vatican to replace himself, to succeed himself at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, making him the highest ranking American ever at the Vatican. And at a luncheon at Time Magazine during the visit, Cardinal Oviedo was asked about the scandal and about some next steps, and he pretty flatly rejected any suggestion that bishops were either responsible in any sort of morally culpable way or would be sanctioned. What he said, interpreting the Pope's words and gestures, he said basically the Pope was trying to set an exemplary model, showing bishops how they should deal with victims in a pastoral, personal way. So he said that the victim stories will continue to get out there. He said he really didn't see anything beyond that, certainly not in a systemic or policy way. After the sort of formal luncheon and kind of Q&A, a couple of us were talking to Cardinal Oviedo, and he mentioned some possible canon law tweaks that could be made. And the New York Times ran with a very high-profile story about that. But even in that story, there weren't really a lot of details about that. And the next day, the Vatican explicitly denied that there were any canon law changes coming. He said anything that had been done, that could be done, had already been done. I think his concern, what he was talking about, was ways to extend the statute of limitations in canon law, because they're very concerned that they realize now that, you know, it takes victims, sexual abuse victims or children, a long time often to be able to go public with these things. And the current statute of limitations at 10 years expires 10 years after a child turns 18, reaches the age of majority in canon law, and that's just not sufficient. And they've found ways around that, and he said there's really not going to be much more in that regard.
Well, let's look at some of the other high points of the trip. You were down in Washington covering the trip for BeliefNet. You also were blogging for Commonweal's blog. What was one of the big things, big events that people were looking forward to was his talk to university presidents and superintendent of schools. Now, partially because of his meeting with the sexual abuse victims, that didn't get as much coverage. What exactly did Benedict say there?
Yeah, it's so funny. The talk to the Catholic educators at the National Shrine was one of the most hyped events, I think, of the visit, that he was going to, somehow read the Riot Act to them. And I think that was mainly a desire on the part of some more conservative Catholic groups on the right. Nobody really expected that. And in fact, it was interesting. I think Benedict just simply laid out the tensions that are there between faith and reason that really come together, that both collide and coexist most intensely in the university forum. And he laid those out, and he made some references to Ex Corde Ecclesiae and the the need to retain a Catholic identity, et cetera. But I don't think, it certainly wasn't in the tone or even in the content of anything, any sort of a reprimand or a rebuke or anything. And I think it just gave the educators and the bishops real food for thought as they continue to work these things out on the ground. So, that was billed as, a big showdown, as one bishop called it to me. But it really was not. And I think what that allowed, I think that was kind of a similar refrain through this visit. Even the United Nations talk was not as overtly kind of prophetic as earlier papal talks at the United Nations. I think Benedict used the UN as his global lectern more than his global pulpit, I think, as other popes had. But what that, I think, allowed to do also, again, is to allow the pastoral side of the Pope and pastoral events to emerge to the fore. The Mass at Nationals Park, beautiful day down in Washington, just a real outpouring of faith and pride in the church. And the same with the closing Mass at Yankee Stadium. It was supposed to be a gray, chilly day, and the sun came out. We wanted to play two, but he insisted just on one. So, again, I think the almost the celebratory aspect, it was as much a celebration of faith and culture as it was, a real catechizing of the faithful. I think long-term impact in the will come as people go back and read the Pope's homilies and his talks and try and, unpack them, because, hey, he came off as a real pastoral presence, but he remains the professor,
right.
A very interesting guy and very, very high concept at times.
So we'll talk in a minute about the two liturgies, which you attended both of them, but maybe we could get back to the UN. It was a surprise to many that he didn't mention the war in Iraq. As you said, he didn't really come out and make a lot of specific statements. Any thoughts as to why he didn't address that subject?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think one thing, there was a real sensitivity to the fact that this is a presidential election year. Yeah. Really wants to avoid that, anything that would be interpreted in political terms. He's just a very old-fashioned man with formal manners, does not want to embarrass his host, President Bush in this case, by saying something publicly. He also didn't want, and he never wants, you know, these issues of politics or things like that to overshadow his essentially spiritual religious message. You know, he wants the theme of truth and the theme of truth in Jesus Christ and a closer adherence to the teachings of the church, and not letting our faith lives and our daily lived lives have such a inconsistency, being more consistent Christians and Catholics. That's the real theme. That's what he wanted to get across. He wanted to be the chief catechist more than, you know, a political figure, even though he's going to the UN and the White House. So consequently, I think all of those things combined to, and also he didn't want people to, you know, see him again as the hardliner kind of emerging. If he had sort of, you know, said something too sharp, you know, he didn't want another Reaganburg. I think that was, Vatican officials said that was a real concern. So he, you know, consciously tried to tone those things down. I think you go back and read the statement, the joint statement from the Holy See and the White House after his private meeting with President Bush, and it lists all the things they talked about, the Middle East and all this kind of thing, all these, you know, environment, etc. You almost kind of read it and you think, oh, I wish he had said some of that to us publicly, you know, said what he thought, but he did not. And I think, you know, that's for many people, that may, you know, in the long run be a bit of a disappointment. For others, it could be a relief.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, perhaps it struck me, reflecting on the visit, that it may have played to his advantage that he had this role at the CDF for so long. He was seen as this enforcer of the faith. So everybody knows where he stands on these doctrinal issues. It's not like he has to come back and say, here's what I believe. Everybody knows it. So in some ways, that played to his advantage. So he could play against type, which he did.
Absolutely. I think in a real sense, the bar was set very low. In terms of his previous reputation. And Vatican officials and church officials have been careful in the pre-trip spin to reiterate that he's not John Paul II. He's not the actor. Look, people were going to welcome him anyway. He had a high approval rating. People just didn't know who he was. So, you know, I think, you know, the expectations were such that, you know, he really had the advantage, like you say, to play against type, to be pastoral. But it's also a matter of policy on his part. He does not want to enter into those discussions. For him, that's settled law, you know, as we would say in jurisprudence. He doesn't want to get into those debates. For him, those just cloud the issue of faith and a true life in Jesus Christ. He wasn't going to touch on those issues. There's not going to be any change on any of the neuralgic issues that people are often interested in or often debate. Those simply are not man's, as he said, those are not man's true questions. So he wasn't going to raise them or answer them.
Well, we were reflecting yesterday in our editorial meeting on the visit, and somebody pointed out, I believe it was perhaps at the Dunwoody event, where he did stress that he wasn't there to, you know, to list prohibitions or you know, to say no, but to say yes, and that's the important part of the Catholic approach. And as somebody noted, that kind of reflects a Vatican II approach to the world, you know, saying yes to the world rather than just pointing out, you know, what you shouldn't do, but, you know, what we should be affirming, you know, what should be life-affirming.
So. Yeah, and he does want to present Christianity, as he calls it, a positive option. You know, he was, one of his nicknames before was Cardinal No, and that was his job before. Now he's the Pope, and he's a symbol of unity, and his is a ministry of unity, as he said. And so he wants to, you know, do, you know, it's not just, and again, he's careful to not to say that we have to assimilate to the world. On the contrary, I think another real theme in this visit was his desire to rebuild a Catholic culture and a strong Catholic identity, to engage the world in order to change the world. So there's a both an openness to the world, but also wanting to make a certain distinctive Catholic identity strong again, so that the church can have a voice that is listened to rather than one that dissipates into the larger society.
Now let's talk about the liturgies. You attended both the Mass at National Stadium in Washington and also at Yankee Stadium. Maybe you could talk about the mood in each place.
Well, I think it was both were a great celebration, I think, in somewhat different ways. I mean, the Nationals Park is so brand new. This first non-baseball event there is great. The press box, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it. It was so nice, you know. And it was just beautifully done. It was a beautiful day. You know, I think the liturgy there was really, you know, reflected America and reflected the diversity, which, you know, even raised some hackles among some of the more conservative commentators who were actually quite critical, in a sense, of the liturgy and its, you know, somewhat less than pre-Vatican II traditional tropes, that, you know, that it was a more modern style. I thought it was very beautiful. And then, you know, and people responded to that. Then you came up and you had the Yankee Stadium closing Mass, which I think was reflected a little more, you know, the New York style of a little bit more old-fashioned kind of liturgy in many respects, and was just beautiful in a different way. It was Yankee Stadium, you know. I'm a Mets fan, so it was a bit of a disappointment to me, but it is a great stadium. Again, you know, the National Stadium, first non-baseball event there. This is going to be the last papal Mass in this old Yankee Stadium.
Which they're tearing down.
Yeah, you can see the huge new Yankee Stadium rising next to it. Who knows who will celebrate Mass there, papal Mass there. You know, and it was a kind of gray day, and the sun came out, and it turned, again, to be a really, you know, beautiful outpouring and a celebration. And you also, I mean, the security was tremendous. I mean, people who cover presidential visits couldn't remember anything like this. And not only for us in the media, but for pilgrims who are coming to these things, you have to realize how many hours ahead that these folks came. Then, you know, a 2 or 2.5 hour Mass. Then so long to get out of the stadium. I mean, it was a real endurance test for a lot of people, and they just bore it quite joyfully and quite wonderfully.
Yes, 57,000 people there total, and untold numbers watching it on TV. And then that night, Sunday night, Pope Benedict got on a plane back to Rome. Now, how does this stack up in terms of the other major events in his papacy? Obviously, as Americans, we see this as a big event. Is this going to be a turning point or sort of a major event in his papacy?
Yes, I do. I think, as you say, there's that temptation to, of course, look at it from the American perspective, from our own, out of our own navel, you know, see kind of our church as the center of the Catholic world, and it's not. And yet, you know, we're 6-7% of the 1.1 billion member church, but of course, it's the United States, and we have an outsized kind of presence and force culturally and religiously and in every other way. But also, you know, above all, while it was a real turning point here, I think because of what he said about the sexual abuse scandal, it will be seen certainly in his legacy as a very important moment for him and for the church. And so I think it will be truly remembered for that. Again, you know, we always get into these kind of speculations, when or will he come back again? And that's, you know, it's a legitimate question. You know, he's 81. He doesn't travel a lot. You know, he waited 3 years after his election to come here. John Paul was here within a year of his election. You know, there's a good chance Benedict will not come back to these shores as Pope. And this, you know, if that's the case, and I think he's very aware of his age and his limitations, and very honest about those. But if that's the case, I think, you know, this visit would stand as a very profound and, again, potentially cathartic and uplifting legacy just on that one level.
Now, from an American angle, we're still just a couple of days away from the visit, and there are a lot of people who are still, you know, on a high. And what do you think is going to be the long-term effect, you know, after this high dies down on the American church?
That's always the tough question. Everybody always wants to know that, because it's so hard to, again, gauge it or, yeah, you know, you're in the midst of these celebrations and all, and everybody is on such a high. And even though there's 50,000-60,000 people, there's also 65 million Catholics out there. How is it getting to the folks in the margins, of the folks who couldn't get in? How is it playing to non-Catholics who might be interested in the church? Is it putting them off, or is it drawing them in? You know, it's really, these things are very hard to gauge. You know, he didn't come here with a list of prescriptions for what ails the American church. I have to say, he was pretty frank at a couple of points, saying that the health of the church, even though he was celebrating it in this bicentenary of the diocese, is precarious. He said, you know, vocations to the priesthood are the true indicator of the health of a church. And he said, I have to be frank, it's not good. When he leaves, when the enthusiasm dies down, these issues are going to remain. And how will those be resolved? And what, or can the Vatican or the Pope do anything on issues of vocations, on the role of women, on the whole range of challenges that are confronting the church? You know, is there anything in a structural way or in a policy way that can help the church to fulfill the mission that Benedict set out? Again, everybody needs the exhortations to a fuller life in Christ are absolutely necessary. You know, how to achieve that and how to make the church more evangelical, let us say, is the difficulty that's left to the bishops and the priests and the lay people.
Well, David Gibson, you'll be continuing to write about some of these topics, at least for the next week or so, on your Benedictions blog and perhaps longer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also your book, The Rule of Benedict. Why don't you give us the full title?
The Rule of Benedict. Not very original, is it? The Rule of Benedict, Pope Benedict XVI and His Battle with the Modern World, from Harper One.
Harper One, that was published about a year and a half ago?
Yeah, and it's out in paperback.
Now, so you can get that on Amazon.com. And we want to thank you very much. I know it's been a busy week for you, for coming in and doing a little sort of post-game analysis.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And I hope you can come back soon.
I'm off to Castel Gandolfo now.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Remind you that you can subscribe to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. You can also leave us comments, which we will occasionally read on the air. We also want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.